the church. He could picture her as precisely as if her photograph had been included in the envelope. Entering the lonely final stages of life, bolstered by yards of taffeta and a half-baked enthusiasm for the new sciences. Her son was doubtless down from Oxford or Cambridge and would bring with him some secret vice, which would either thrill Colchester or make him completely unsuited to civilized company. She probably lived on a diet of boiled potatoes and vinegar, hoping Byron's diet might improve her silhouette, and would almost certainly have Anglo-Catholic tendencies and deplore the absence of an ornate cross on the All Saints' altar. In the space of 5 minutes, he furnished her with an obnoxious lapdog, a toadying companion with no flesh on her bones, and a squint. His sole consolation was that Old Winter was so resolutely unpicturesque a destination that he couldn't imagine a society woman, even a bored and meddlesome widow, troubling to visit. Each spring, a few ardent naturalists arrived to document the handful of seabirds that passed through the salt marshes, but even these tended to be the drabbest species imaginable. Their muddy feathers, so indistinguishable from their surroundings, they often passed without notice. Old Winter had only one inn and two stores, and though its village green was occasionally considered the longest, if not the largest, in Essex, there was very little to recommend it, even to its own inhabitants. Aside from the church's curiosities, which were, in truth, a minor embarrassment to each successive incumbent, the only item of interest within 5 miles was the blackened hull of a clipper, which could be seen when the Blackwater estuary lay at low tide, and which the village children decorated each harvest in a kind of pagan rite of which he dutifully disapproved. The train line terminated 7 miles to the west, so that the farmers still relied on barges to carry oats and barley to the mills at St. Osyth and onward to London for sale. Perhaps the best that could be said for Old Winter was that if it was neither wealthy nor beautiful, it was at least not particularly poor. It was not in the Essex character to succumb miserably to change and decay, and when John Barleycorn came under threat from cheap imports, one or two tenant farmers had tried their hand at caraway and coriander, and shared the higher cost of a threshing engine, which not only increased their output to a startling degree, but gave the entire village a festive air as the children gathered to marvel at its size, its thunderous voice, and its gusts of steam. Will felt an ill temper settle on him, and resisting the urge to toss the envelope onto the fire, hid it behind a sheet of paper presented to him that morning by John, the youngest of his boys. It was a drawing which might have been of an alligator which had acquired a set of wings, but might equally have been a greatly enlarged caterpillar eating a moth. His mother was convinced it was the latest demonstration of his genius. But Will was unconvinced. He remembered his own childhood, spent filling notebooks with engines and devices so complex he'd clean forget their purpose from one page to the next. But what had come of that? And it was not only the threat of a probably harmless widow that dampened his mood, but the trouble that had lately settled on the parish. He surveyed John's drawing, and this time took it for a winged sea dragon approaching the village. Since the discovery on New Year's morning of a drowned man down on the Blackwater marshes, naked, his head turned almost 180 degrees, a look of dread in his wide-open eyes, the Essex serpent had ceased to be merely a device to keep children in check and had begun to stalk the streets. On Friday nights in the white hair, drinkers claimed to have seen it. Children playing on the saltings needed no urging to come home before dark, and no amount of reasoning on Will's part could persuade them the drowned man was a victim of nothing more than drink and the tides. He resolved to shake himself into a better frame of mind by walking a circuit of the parish, looking up a few folk as he went, quelling rumours of a sea dragon wherever they arose. He took up his hat and coat, and there was whispering at the study door. The children were forbidden entry, but were not above trying the handle. He bellowed threats of bread and water for a fortnight, and made his habitual escape through the window. Old Winter that day was aptly named. Frost lay on the hard earth, and black oaks clutched the pale sky. Will thrust his hands into his pockets and set out. The red brick house behind had been new the day he'd first crossed the threshold, Stella coming slowly up the tiled pathway with her swollen belly cradled in her hands, and Joanna bringing up the rear, trailing an invisible pet, species never established, on a length of string. Bay windows on both floors gave the impression of shallow turrets on either side of the front door, above which a fanlight in coloured glass caught an hour of light each afternoon. The largest house on the single street which passed through the village, leading south from Colchester and terminating at the small dock where a single barge now lay at anchor. It had a bright, hard look, entirely out of keeping with the rest of the village. He never thought there was much to recommend it, save good insulation and a garden large enough to lose the children for hours at a stretch, but knew himself blessed. At least one of his peers endured a house which seemed to be sinking into the ground, and in which fungus, the size of a man's hand, grew in the upper corners of the dining room. Coming onto the street they called High Lane, in deference to its slight elevation above sea level, Will bore left, where it passed through common ground. A few sheep grazed listlessly under the old winter oak, said to have once sheltered troops loyal to the traitor Charles, and which appeared so black it might have been burned to charcoal. Its lower branches had sunk beneath their own weight, and curving down, thrust into the earth, and after a while up again, so that in the spring the tree appeared surrounded by saplings. The down-curved branches formed seats where in summer lovers sat, and as Will passed, a woman spread her red skirts and tossed out a few scraps for the birds. Beyond the oak, set back from the road behind a mossy wall, All Saints with its modest tower made its usual call on him. He ought, really, to sit there a while on a bare cold pew and wait for a cooling of his temper. But someone might be waiting in the shadows for blessing or censure. In the year past, with the coming of the Essex Serpent, which he took to calling the Trouble, reluctant to christen a rumour, claims on his time had grown steadily greater. There was a feeling, mostly unspoken, at least in his presence, that they were all under judgment, doubtless well deserved, from which only he could deliver them. But what comfort could he offer which would not also affirm their sudden fear? He could not do it any more than he could say to John, who so often woke at night, "You and I will go together at midnight and slay the creature that lives under your bed." What was built on deceit, however kindly done, would not withstand the first blow. And time enough for pulpit and pew tomorrow, when the sun rose on the Lord's day. For now, he felt such an urgent desire to look out on the saltings and fill himself with the empty air that he almost ran. On past the white hare, "My dear Mansfield, impossible for a man of the cloth, as I think you know." And past the neat small cottages with cyclamen on the windowsill. "She's very well, thank you. The flu is gone, praise God." To the place where High Lane sloped down to the quay. Hardly that, of course. Simply an inlet on the Blackwater, bolstered with stonework that only ever seemed to last a season and was remade each spring out of whatever fell to hand. Henry Banks, who racketed up and down the estuary in his barge, conveying who knew what to who knew where, beneath his sacks of corn and barley, sat cross-legged on the deck mending his sails, his cold hands livid as the cloth. Seeing Will, he beckoned him over, saying, "Still no sign of her, Reverend. Still no sign." Pulling dolefully at a hip flask. Some months had passed since Banks had lost a rowing boat and been refused his insurance on the grounds that he'd failed to make it fast to the quay, being probably drunk at the time. Banks felt the grievance deeply and told anyone who'd listened that it'd been stolen away in the night by oystermen from over Mersey way, and that he'd always been a truthful man, as Gracie would have witnessed, had she still been living, God rest her. "No, I'm sorry for it, Banks," said Will sincerely. "Nothing's harder to bear than injustice. I'll keep a lookout, mind." He refused a nip of rum, gesturing ruefully at his collar, and moved on, past the quay, the low water always to his right, where up ahead, on a slight incline, a row of bare ash trees were like so many grey feathers stuck in the ground. Beyond the ashes was the last Old Winter house, which, for as long as he could remember, they'd called World's End. Its bowed walls were bound together with moss and lichen, and over the years it had been added to so that by degrees of lean-to and annex it had doubled in size and seemed a living thing feasting on the hard earth. The portion of land around it was fenced off on three sides. The fourth gave directly onto the grasses of the salt marsh, and from there down to the pale stretch of mud riddled with creek that glistened in the weak sun. As Will approached World's End, its sole resident was so nearly camouflaged against the walls of the house that when he emerged it was as if by a charm. Mr. Cracknell seemed made of the same stuff as his home, his coat green as moss and quite as damp, and his beard reddish as the clay tiles that fell from the roof. He held in his right hand the small grey body of a mole, and in his left a folded knife.
"Stand back, her little reverend, for the good of your coat," he said,
and Will obeyed, seeing that strung all along the fence were a dozen moles or more. But these were skinned, and their hides hung from their hindquarters like a shadow. Their pale paws, so like the hands of children, reached blindly for the earth. Will inspected the body nearest.
"Quite a haul, and a penny apiece."
Man's dominion over animals notwithstanding, he'd never been able to shake a fondness for the little gentlemen in their velvet jackets, and wished the farmer's war of attrition could be ended by kinder means.
"Her penny apiece is right, and warm work besides."
He laid the creature out, and deftly cut a loop at wrist and ankle.
20 years an Old Winter man, and still your customs surprise me. Is there no better way of keeping moles from the crops than by scaring them off with their slaughtered brethren?"
Cracknell frowned.
"Oh, I've a purpose in mind, parson. You know that. You see, I have a purpose in mind."
Delighted, the man slipped a forefinger between flesh and skin and tested the ease with which he could part them.
I am aware that in some quarters I am considered not as they see the full shilling. Not that I've lately seen a shilling, being content with such pence as might now and then come my way.
And here a pause, and a direct glance at Will's pockets, then down again to the task at hand.
And yet there you stand, God's own man, and ask if I have a purpose.
I felt it, said Will, gravely, as if by instinct.
The tearing of skin from flesh was like that of paper. Cracknell lifted his handiwork, inspecting it, well pleased with his skill. A ribbon of steam unfurled from the hot, bare body in the cold air.
Scaring them off! Oh, yes!
His jovial mood fractured. He busied himself with a length of wire, which he ran through the animal's pink nose, nostril to nostril, and looped three times around the fence post.
"Scaring them off," says he, "though of what I might be scaring off, there mightn't be knowing now or later, I dare say, when a voice is heard of weeping and lamentation for our children, because they are not, and we will not be comforted."
His hand on the wire trembled a little, and Will was appalled to see that so also did his lower lip. His first impulse, which came as much from training as from instinct, was to offer a word of comfort. But hard on its heels came a flash of irritation. So, the old man, too, had succumbed to whatever trick of the light had the whole village taken in. He thought of his daughter running home, weeping in terror at what might be creeping up river towards them, and of notes slipped in the collection box, urging he preach repentance of whatever sins had brought judgment to their door.
"Mr. Cracknell,"
briskly, with a little humour perhaps, let him see that there was nothing to fear but a long winter and a tardy spring.
"Mr. Cracknell, I may not quite be episcopal material, but I know misquoted scripture when I hear it. Our children are in no more danger now than they have ever been. Where are your wits? What have you done with them?"
Reaching out, he made a show of patting the other man's pockets. "You don't mean to tell me you've strung up these poor beasts to fend off some rumoured sea serpent in the black water?" Cracknell was coaxed into a smile.
"Gentlemanly of you to allude to my wits at all, Parson, on account of the general disbelief that I ever was in possession of such a thing as wits."
He patted the mole on its stripped back with a fond gesture.
"For all that, though, I do say and always have said that caution is the side best erred on, and if man or creature were minded to make their approaches here at World's End, my little scare beasts here would give them pause."
He jerked his thumb towards the rear of his dwelling, where a pair of tethered goats industriously cropped a circle of grass.
"I've Gog and Magog here for companionship, you understand, in addition to providing the milks and the cheeses which Mrs. Ransom is so kind as to enjoy, and I'll not risk their loss. Not I. I'll not be left alone."
There was the trembling again. But here Will felt on firmer ground. 3 times in 3 years he'd stood with Cracknell at the graveside. First wife, then sister, then son.
He clasped the old man by the shoulder. "Nor shall you. I have my flock, and you have yours, and the same shepherd has their care."
"That's as may be, and I thank you for it. But I'll not be darkening your church door tomorrow, all the same. I made my stand, parson. Take Mrs. Cracknell and the Almighty will have to make do without me. You recall were my words, and I'll not be dissuaded, come high or low water."
He wore now the mulish expression of a stubborn child, which was so greatly preferable to the threat of tears, that it took Will an effort not to laugh, and instead to say quite gravely, and conscious of the cost of a bargain struck with God, "You made your stand, and I've no right to come between a man and his word." Out on the saltings, water crept towards the house, and the lowering sun was cold. Beyond the marsh, Old Winter's outlook was not of some other village on the far bank of the Black Water, but of a broad horizon where the estuary met the North Sea. Will saw the lights of a fishing vessel headed home, and thought of Stella, tired by now, her small hands busy with the children, drawing back the curtain to look past Traitor's Oak and see him coming, longing for her. And for the sound of children at his study door, gave him a sudden distaste for the mossy house sinking into its patch of land. Then he remembered Cracknell at the graveyard throwing a clod of earth onto a small pine coffin, and stood a while longer at the gate.
"A minute more, Reverend," said Cracknell. "I have something for you."
He was absorbed again into the side of the house, then emerged a moment later with a brace of handsome, bright-eyed rabbits, newly caught, and thrust them at Will.
"With my compliments to Mrs. Ransom, who needs her strength on account of the child-bearing years, which, as Mrs. Cracknell says, tends to a thinning of the blood."
The pleasure of giving illuminated him, and Will took them graciously, feeling a restriction in his throat. "Quite a pie they'd make," he said. "And Johnny's favourite, as it happened." Then, as if he wanted to give something in return, he hung the rabbits from his belt, in the farmer's fashion, and said, "Mr. Cracknell, tell me what you've seen, because I cannot think whom to believe or when. A poor man drowned, but after all drowning's not so rare in winter. A sheep was gutted, I'm told, but foxes must make their living too. And the child they said was lost overnight was found in the morning in a linen cupboard eating her mother's sweets. Banks brings strange news on his barge from St. Osyth and Malden, but you and I know him for a liar, do we not? Then there are whisperings in doorways and outside the inn, and they say a baby was snatched from a boat at Point Clare. But whoever took an infant to sea when the days are short and cold? Tell me you have yourself witnessed something to fear, and then perhaps I'll believe it." He fixed his gaze on the old man's eyes, which could not quite seem to meet his. They slid over his shoulder to the empty horizon behind. Knowing the value of silence, Will refused to speak, and in a moment Cracknell, sighing, shrugging, busying himself with his knife, said,
"The point is not what I see, but what I feel. I cannot see the ether, yet I feel it enter and depart, and depend upon it. We feel that something is coming sooner or later, my words be marked. It has been before, as well as you know, and it will come again, If not in my lifetime, in yours, or in your children's, or in your children's children's. And so I will gird my loins up, parson, and if I might make bold a moment, I would recommend that you do similar.
Will thought of the church with its carved remnant of the old legend, and wished, not for the first time, that he'd taken hammer and chisel to it on the morning of his arrival.
"I have always put great store on you, Mr. Cracknell, and will continue to do so. Perhaps you can consider yourself the old winter watchman out here at World's End, and set a beacon in your garden for a warning. The Lord make his face to shine upon you, whether you want it or not," said Will, and on this light blessing, turned and left for home. He imagined himself walking just a little faster than the night, so that he might arrive at the door a moment before darkness. Cracknell's scare-beasts and his visible fear had given him pause, not because he thought some aberration lay waiting in the black water, biding its time, but because he felt it a failing of his that his parish could have succumbed to such godless superstition. No one could agree on its size, form, or origins, but there seemed a consensus that it favoured the river and the dawn. There had been no witness to any attack, but in the weeks since the end of summer the unseen thing had been blamed for every mislaid child and every broken limb. He'd even heard it said that its urine poisoned the water pump down at Fettlewell and caused the sickness which had left three dead on New Year's Eve. Resisting Stella's gentle suggestion that he speak directly from the pulpit, he'd instead chosen a brisk refusal to acknowledge the trouble, not even when he discovered that each Sunday morning the congregation, with unspeaking unity, would not sit in the pew with the serpent carving, as if being near it put flesh and bones on their terror. The night at his heels, he walked on, turning once to see the white moon rising with its marred face. The wind strengthened in the reeds, which gave out a single mournful note, and Will felt a quickening just behind his ribs that was very like fear, and laughed. There! How easy it was to turn your face from nothing more than a shadow. And perhaps it would be wise to make use of the trouble, if it proved impossible to ignore. Few things turned the heart to eternity more surely than fear. The old winter lights appeared up ahead, and somewhere among them his family waited, their bodies solid, warm, soap-scented, each with the fine fair down on their cheeks he'd carried as a boy. Wholly real, impossible to deny, never for a moment quiet or still, so that no shadow could contain them. And he felt such a rush of joy that he gave a quiet shout. And was it also one of warning or challenge, in case there was, after all, a wild dog loose? And ran the half-mile home. John was waiting, standing one-footed on the gatepost in his white nightclothes. Seeing Will, he roared,
"By the pricking of my thumbs!"
and buried his face in his father's coat. Feeling the rabbit fur on his neck, he said,
"You've done it! You've brought me a pet!"
Cora Seaborn, care of the Red Lion Inn, Colchester, 14th of February. "My dear imp, how are you? Are you keeping warm? Are you eating properly? How's your cut? Have you healed? I'd have liked to have seen it. Did it go very deep? You must keep your scalpels sharp and your wits sharper. Oh, dear. I do miss you. We are well, and Martha sends her... Oh, you won't believe that, will you? Francis doesn't send his love at all, but I don't think he'd mind seeing you again if you were to come down, and that's as much as any of us can hope for. Will you come down? It's cold, but the sea air is good, and Essex nowhere near as bad as they say. I've been over to Walton on the Naze and out to St. Osyth, and I haven't found my sea dragon yet, not even a bit of crinoid sea lily. But you know I don't give in easily. The man who owns the hardware store here thinks me mad as a hatter and has sold me 2 new hammers and a kind of suede belt to hang them from. Martha says I never looked odder or uglier, but you know I've always thought beauty a curse and am more than happy to dispense with it completely. Sometimes I forget that I am a woman, at least. I forget to think of myself as a woman. All the obligations and comforts of womanhood seem to have nothing to do with me now. I'm not sure how I am supposed to behave, and I'm not sure I would, if I knew. Talking of distinguished, you'll never guess who accosted us in the high street just as we were looking for a civilized place to wait out the rain. Charles Ambrose, looking just like a parrot in a flock of pigeons, bustling about in his velvet coat. He's adamant I need an Essex friend to keep me from broken limbs out on the mudflats, or worse. He tells me the River Blackwater is menaced by a beast, but I will tell you all about it when I see you next. He has threatened to put me in touch with some rural vicar, and though I'm half tempted to take him up on the offer, purely for the pleasure of shocking whatever poor old fella he has in mind, I really would rather be left to my own devices. Won't you come down, dear? I miss you. I don't like to do without you. I don't see why I should. Love, Cora. Luke Garrett, M.D., Pentonville Road, N1, 15th February. Cora! Hand better, thanks. The infection was useful. I tested out my new Petri dishes and made some bacterial cultures. I thought you would have liked them. They were blue and green. Coming down with Spencer, probably next week. See you then. Hold off the rain, if you can. Luke. P.S. Technically, that was a Valentine. Don't deny it.
Chapter 4 5 miles east of Colchester, Cora walked in fine rain. She'd set out with no destination in mind and no thought to how she'd come home, only wanting to get out of the cold room in the Red Lion where Francis had cut his pillow to retrieve and count the feathers. Neither she nor Martha had been able to explain why it was that he ought not to have done it.
"Yes, but you can pay for it, and then it will all be mine."
And rather than listen to her son's patient totting up, 173, as the door had closed, she'd belted up her coat and run downstairs. Martha heard her call.
"I'll be home before it's dark. I have money with me. I'll find someone to bring me back."
And sighing, had returned to the boy. Colchester had dwindled behind her in a matter of half an hour, and she'd walked east, almost persuading herself she could reach the mouth of the Blackwater before she grew tired. She skirted around a village. She wanted neither to be seen nor spoken to, and favoured overgrown paths that ran along the rim of oak woods. Traffic was sparse and slow, and no one spared a glance for the woman walking on the verge. When the rain set in, she delved deeper between the trees, turning her face to the featureless sky. It was a uniform grey, without shifting of clouds or sudden blue breaks, and no sign at all of the sun. It was an unwritten sheet of paper, and against it the bare branches were black. It ought to have been dreary, but Cora saw only beauty. Birches unfurled their strips of bark like lengths of white cloth, and under her feet wet leaves were slick. Everywhere, bright moss had taken hold in dense wads of green fur, swaddling the trees at their foot, and fine pelts on broken branches that lay across the path. She tripped twice on brambles that held scraps of white wool and little feathers grey at the tip, and swore at them without malice. It struck her that everything under that white sky was made of the same substance, not quite animal, but not merely earth. Where branches had sheared from their trunks, they left bright wounds, and she would not have been surprised to see severed stumps of oak and elm pulse as she passed. Laughing, she imagined herself part of it, and leaning against a trunk in earshot of a chattering thrush, held up her arm and wondered if she might see vivid green lichen stippling the skin between her fingers. Had it always been here, this marvellous black earth in which she sank to her ankles, this coral-coloured fungus frilling the branches at her feet? Had birds always sung? Had the rain always this light touch, as if she might inhabit it? She supposed they had, and that it had never been very far from her door. She supposed there must have been other times when she'd laughed alone into the wet bark of a tree, or exclaimed to no one over the fineness of a fern unfolding. But she could not remember them. The past few weeks had not always been so happy. At times she remembered her grief, and for long stretches in which it was necessary to teach herself again how to draw breath, she would feel the cavity open behind her ribs. It was a kind of draining sensation, as if a vital organ had been shared with the man who died and was atrophying slowly from misuse. In those cold minutes, she would recall not the years of unease in which she'd never once successfully judged his mood or circumnavigated the methods of his wounding, but their first few months, which were the last of her youth. Oh, she had loved him. No one could ever have loved more. She'd been too young to withstand it, a child intoxicated by an inch of drink. He had been imprinted on her vision as if she'd glanced at the sun and, closing her eyes, found a pinprick of light persisting in the darkness. He had been so sombre that when attempts at levity made him laugh, she'd felt an empress in command of an army. He was so stern and so remote that the first moment he embraced her had been a battle won. She'd not known then that these were the common tricks of a common trickster, to seed a skirmish and later lay her waste. In the years that followed, her fear of him was so very like her love, attended by the same fast-paced heart, the same broken nights, the same alertness to his footstep in the hall, that she was drunk on that, too. No other man had touched her, and so she could not tell how strange it was to be subject to pain as much as pleasure. No other man had loved her, and so she could not judge whether the sudden withdrawal of his approval was natural as the tide and as implacable. By the time it occurred to her that she ought to divorce him, it was too late. At that stage, Frances could not tolerate so much as an altered lunch hour, and any change would have risked his health. Besides, the boy's presence, for all his troublesome rituals and inscrutable tempers, had given Cora the single sensation in life about which she felt no confusion at all. He was her son, and she knew her duty. She loved him, and sometimes suspected he loved her too. The scant wind paused. The oak wood held its tongue. Cora again was 20, and her son was come bawling into the world with his fists clenched. They'd wanted to take him from her and swaddle him in white cloth. She'd roared and wouldn't let them. He'd crawled blindly from belly to breast and sucked so strongly the midwife marvelled and said what a good boy he was, and a clever one. Hours it had been, surely, of their gazes meeting, his eyes fixed intently on her, the dark hazy blue of evening. "I have an ally," she thought. "He will never let me go." Days passed, and she felt herself split down the middle, a wound that would never heal and which she would never regret. Because of him, her heart would always be exposed to wind and weather. She worshipped him with many small acts of devotion, wondering at his marvellous foot, its skin like the thin silk covering of a cushion. She passed hours in stroking it with the tip of her finger and seeing how he spread his toes in delight, that he could take pleasure, that she could give it. His curled hand was a cockle shell warmed by the sun. She held it between her lips. She was astonished by him, that those small hands, those feet, contained such multitudes. But it had been only a matter of weeks before the blinds went down. The eyes, she sometimes thought, actually clouding over. If she nursed him, it appeared to cause him pain, or at least a rage he could not contain. If she held him, he struggled, flailed, cut her eyelid with the sharp little nail on his thumb. Their days of adoration seemed remote, impossible. Bewildered by this second rejection of her love, she began to withhold it out of shame. Her failure was a source of amusement to Michael, who said that after all it was vulgar to be entertained by one's own children, and she'd best leave him to nurses and tutors. Years passed. She learned his ways, and he hers. If their relationship bore little resemblance to the careless warmth she witnessed between other mothers and their sons, it was serviceable enough, and it was theirs. On she walked, and though the cold rain and the black earth ought to have dispirited her, she could not summon up her widow's grief. A kind of gurgling bubbled from her throat and came out in a shameless peal of laughter which startled the silent birds into speech. She was ashamed of it, of course, but was used to feeling that she lived in a state of disgrace, and felt certain she'd concealed her growing happiness from everyone but Martha. At the thought of her friend, sitting scowling in a coffee shop, no doubt, to escape Frankie's latest obsession, or passing the time by enchanting the proprietor of the Red Lion, the laugh subsided, and Cora lifted her arms up a little, imagining seeing her coming towards her under the dripping trees. At night, they lay back to back under a thin quilt with knees drawn up against the cold, sometimes turning to murmur a fragment of remembered gossip, or say, good night, sometimes waking, cradled in the crook of an arm. The simplicity of it had sustained Cora when everything else had sent her flying, and if Martha had been afraid that she'd be no longer needed now, Cora stood on firmer ground, she'd been mistaken. Coming to her eighth mile and growing tired, Cora found herself on a slight rise where the trees began to thin. The drizzle subsided and cleared the air, and without any sunlight breaking through the low white canopy, the world flushed with colour. Everywhere, reddish banks of last year's bracken glowed, and above them gorse thickets burned with early blooms of yellow. A little aimless flock of sheep, with purple ink splashed on their haunches, looked up briefly from their grazing, and shrugging turned away. The path on which she stood was bright Essex clay, and a little further down the incline a fallen tree had been overtaken by a thick covering of vivid moss. The change of scene was like a change in altitude. It took her breath, and she paused for a moment to adjust herself to it. In the silence, a curious sound reached her. It was a little like a child crying, but a child old enough to know better. She could not make out any words, only an odd choking, whinnying noise, which fell silent for moments at a time, then started up again. Then another voice joined it, and it was the voice of a man, crooning, patient, deep, wordless also, though, she listened harder, not quite.
"Now! Now! Now!"
After a pause, during which her heartbeat thrummed, although she later claimed she'd never been afraid, the man's voice set up again, only this time at a higher, rougher pitch. She could not quite divine the words, but thought, in among the frantic urging, was,
"Oh, damn you! Damn you!"
Then there was the sound of something heavy striking something soft, and another choked little bray. At this, she hitched up her coat, which was too long and had grown heavy with mud at the hem, and followed the sound. The clay path led over the slight rise and down again, between high, pale green hedges, on which twisted black seed pods rattled as she passed. A little further down, and she saw an acre of that russet bracken opening before her, with a few sheep nosing at the earth. To her left, overlooked by a bare oak, there was a shallow lake. Its water was thick with mud and speckled with rain. No reeds grew, and there were no birds busy on the bank. It was entirely featureless, except that on the nearer bank a man stooped, struggling over something pale, which made frantic movements and gave out another weak cry. The sound of it struck and sickened her, and there was something familiar in the wretched imploring movements it made, so that when she gathered pace and began to run, what she had hoped would be an imperious "Stop that! Stop!" came out as a shriek. The man may have heard her, or he may not. He neither lifted his head nor stopped whatever he was doing. His voice had lowered again to the curious deep crooning noise she first had heard, only now it seemed to her appalling that he should be so tender when he was causing so much harm. As she drew nearer, she saw his feet planted firmly in muddy water and his back in a dark winter coat splashed with mud. Even from that distance, she saw that he was shabby and rough-looking. Everything about him was dirty, from the thick, wet fabric of his clothes to the damp curls falling over his collar. If the old stories were right, she thought, and man had been first made from a handful of dust, here was Adam himself, all mud, ill-formed, without the full powers of speech.
"What are you doing? Stop!"
At this, he half turned, and she saw that he was not much above medium height and bulky. Smears of mud on his face gave the impression of a beard, and from the filth a pair of eyes blazed at her. He might have been 60, or he might have been 20. He had rolled his sleeves to his elbows, and his forearms were thickly corded with muscle, and as if deciding she'd neither help nor hinder, he shrugged and turned back to his task. Nothing infuriated Cora more than being ignored. She gave an exasperated cry and ran the few remaining yards. Reaching the water's rim, she saw that the pale thing struggling beneath the man was a sheep, dumbly struggling in the shallows, and she was rinsed with relief. Whatever horror she'd imagined, it was not this. The sheep rolled its stupid eyes at the newcomer and bleated. Its hindquarters were blackened to the waist with mud, and with frantic workings of its rear legs, it contrived to sink a little deeper. The man had his right arm hooked beneath its left foreleg and around its back, and with his left he was attempting to grasp its flank, the better to haul it to safety, but his feet could not find a purchase on the slick earth. The movement frightened the animal, which had closed its eyes for a moment, as if resigned to its own end. It bleated and struggled again, and with its left foreleg flailed out and struck the man across his cheek. He yelped, and Cora saw a wound open beneath the mask of mud. The sight of blood roused her from her reverie. She said, "Let me help!" And he gave a breathless grunt of assent. "Man's a half-wit," she thought, already wondering how to tell the tale to best please her friends. Again the sheep went limp, exhaling a long kind of sigh that plumed in the air and allowed the man to clasp both arms behind its back. In their embrace, the two sank together into the mud, and looking furiously over his shoulder, the man said, "Well, come on!" Not quite a half-wit then, though with slow Essex bowels. Cora reached for her belt, which was broad and meant for a man. Her fingers were stiff and slow, and she fumbled with the buckle as the sighing sheep slipped further down. Then she tugged it free and, dashing forward, looped the belt across the animal's back where it would catch in the crook beneath its forelegs, forming a kind of bridle. The man released his grip and tugged the strap from her hand, and the animal felt the loss of his grasp and panicked. It gave a convulsive movement that threw Cora into the mud. The man showed her no concern, only grunted, "Up! Get up!" And, gesturing that she should take the belt, again resumed his grip on the sheep's flank. There was a long moment in which their matched strength slowly worked against the sucking mud, and Cora felt the bones of her shoulders straining in their sockets. Then all at once the sheep's rear legs appeared above the water surface, and it propelled itself forward onto the bank. Cora and the man fell back, and she turned away to conceal her breathlessness. She would not have minded the mud and the pain in her wrists had the man not been an oaf and the sheep not such a witless beast. Some distance away, the sheep's companions looked warily up, showing no pleasure awaiting the lost one's return. It ought to have felt, she thought, like a triumph. But instead the pleasure of the day had gone, and even the banks of bracken had lost their colour. When she turned back, the man was regarding her above his sleeve, which he had pressed to the cut on his cheek. He had put on a knitted hat, which was so poorly made he might well have put it together himself from scarlet scraps and pulled it to his eyebrows, which were thick with mud and almost obscured his eyes. He said, "Thanks," a little curtly, again with that flattening of the vowels that marked him out as a countryman. "A farmer, then," she thought, and without accepting the gratitude so grudgingly given, she said, gesturing to the exhausted sheep, "Is it going to be all right?" It mouthed at the air and rolled its eyes again. He shrugged.
"Should think so."
"One of yours?"
"Ha! No, not my flock."
The idea evidently struck some chord of slow humour in him, and he began to chuckle.
A vagrant, then, poor soul. It was in her nature to think well of folk until they gave her cause to do otherwise, and besides, she'd shortly be home to Martha and their clean white sheets, and who knew but that he might be making his bed in the bracken with nothing but a half-drowned beast for company. Smiling, she decided to bring good London manners to their conversation.
"Well, I must be home. It was very nice to meet you." She gestured towards the dripping oaks and the pond where little eddies from their struggle still moved, and wishing to be generous, said,
"Essex! Nice part of the world."
"Is it?"
His voice was dampened by the sleeve still pressed against his cheek, on which she could see blood mixed in with dirty water. She wanted to ask if he would be all right, if he'd make it safely home, if there was anything she could do. But it was his territory, not hers. It occurred to her, as she saw the first thickening of the shadows at dusk, that of the pair of them, she was most at a loss, miles from her bed and with only a vague sense of where she stood. With a fair attempt at maintaining what she felt was the upper hand, she said,
"Tell me, am I far from Colchester? Where can I fetch a cab home?"
The man lacked the wit to be surprised. He nodded towards the further bank, where she could make out a breach in the line of oaks, and behind it an open stretch of land.
"Out onto the road, bare left, 500 yards. There's a pub. They'll fetch it for you."
Then, with a motion extraordinarily like that of a man dismissing an inferior, he turned and trudged away through the mud. His shoulders were so stooped against the cold that the weight of his filthy coat made him seem very like a hunchback. Always more easily moved to mirth than rage, Cora could not prevent herself from laughing. Perhaps he heard, because he paused on the path, half turned towards her, then thought better of it, and went on his way. Cora tugged her coat closer, and heard all around her the gathering of birds for evensong. The sheep had dragged itself a yard or two further onto the bank. It had raised itself into a kneeling position and was nudging the earth in search of a blade of grass. The light was fading, and a fine white mist rose up from the cold earth and spilled over the rim of her boots. Beyond the last of the oaks, a grass verge dropped a little to the roadside, and in the near distance, a half-timbered pub with bright-lit windows beckoned to passing travellers. The sight of the gleaming panes, and the thought that she was still so far from home, and that she did not know the way, brought on a weariness so sudden it struck her like a blow. When she reached the threshold and saw a woman leaning on the bar and smiling a welcome beneath a high coil of bright hair, Cora paused to adjust her clothes. Smoothing her coat, she found in the buckle of her belt a little scrap of white wool, and on it, gleaming in the lamplight as though it were fresh, a smear of blood.
Chapter 5 Joanna Ransom, not quite 13, tall as her father and wrapped in his newest coat, held her hand over flames. She brought her palm as near the flicker as she could, then withdrew it slowly enough to preserve her pride. Her brother, John, watched solemnly, and would have liked to have thrust his own hands into his pockets, but had been instructed to leave them to grow as cold as he could bear.
"We are making a sacrifice," she'd said,
leading him to the stretch of land just beyond World's End, where the marshes gave way to the Blackwater estuary, and beyond that, the sea.
"And for there to be a sacrifice, we must suffer."
Earlier that day, She'd explained to him, whispering in cold corners, that something was rotten in the village of Old Winter. There was the drowned man, for one thing, naked, they said, and with 5 deep scratches on his thigh. And the sickness at Fettlewell, and the way